Today's Teisho will be on Case 56 in the Book of Serenity, Spiritual Uncle Me and the Rabbit. Introduction: Better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. Devadatta experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven while in uninterrupted hell. Rudraka Ramaputra fell from the heaven of the summit of existence into the body of a flying wildcat. Tell me, where is the gain and loss? Case: As Dongshan and his spiritual uncle Ni were walking along, they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. Ni said, "Swift!" Dongshan said, "How?" Ni said, "It's like a commoner being made a prime minister." Dongshan said, "Such a venerable old person still says such words." Ni said, "Then what about you?" Dongshan said, "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty." Verse: Matching strength with snow and frost, walking evenly through clouds and sleet, Zha Hui left the country, Zhang Ru crossed the bridge. Zhao and Zhao's strategy was able to establish the Han. Zhao and Yu and Zhu wanted to avoid Yao completely. Favor and disgrace are disturbing. Profoundly trust in yourself. In the real state, one mixes tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. Today is the second day of our sesshin, our beautiful spring sesshin. Everybody did a wonderful job this morning on the cushion. And I want to just urge you to continue to practice with that kind of diligence. You know, this second day of sesshin is really a very special day. That usually day one of sesshin, people are still able to hold on to their strength. You know, people come to sesshin, and if they're in good health and so on, they have a lot of residual stamina and strength, and it gets them through the physical challenge, you know, of day one of sesshin. But by day two of sesshin, it's often the case that even like, you know, people who are very strong and fit are hanging on by their by their fingers, by their fingernails. You know, it's just all you can do to survive. And later in the sesshin, people we often adjust. You know, after like day three, it's less of a struggle, and so on. But days one, two, and three can really be a struggle, even if you've been practicing for many years. And it certainly used to be the case for me. You know, the first couple of days of sesshin can just knock you on your butt. And I always used to get sick. You know, it would just seem like I would come to sesshin, and first couple of days I would just be, it would just be like, everything would just be like a blur, right? And I would always get like cold sores. You know, I used to actually carry in my medicine kit something called Campophenique, which is a camphor medicine for cold sores. And I think it's gone out of business now. They have some new super duper medicine for that now, but it worked pretty well. You know, but if you kept using it, within 7 to 10 days, your cold sore was gone. In other words, your cold sore healed by itself, but you felt better. It didn't hurt, so it sort of numbed the cold sore. And it helped me, I was just a wreck in the first, for years and years. And only later did I realize that that really, at those moments, in those days, those first difficult days of sesshin, my mind was the sweetest and the purest, the cleanest that it was ever going to be during the whole sesshin. And really, later in the sesshin, you know, sometimes you'll notice you actually lose focus. You know, it can happen. Not eventually, it won't happen, but when you're sort of an intermediate stage, those first 2 or 3 days are just like being run over by a car, you know, basically. And then later on, you begin to feel a little better, and when you feel a little better, a lot of your habits return. So these first days are really precious, precious opportunity to get knocked on your butt and to be really just barely able to survive. And that's a really wonderful state. It really is, just barely able to survive. You know, we live in a culture where people have, just like ridiculous abundance. It's just like absurd beyond anybody's wildest imagination. When my mother grew up in a part of the United States which was quite poor. Upstate New York is a very poor region around Plattsburgh, and a lot of people were farmers up there. There wasn't really much industry, and there's only the country. The ground is not very good for it's very short growing season. It's so far north. So dairy cattle is the only way people could make a living. And on the coasts, people fish, right? Again, you can't really make much of a living farming. So for 100 years, people have been living there, maybe longer, as dairy farmers. But that's a really hand-to-mouth operation, you know. So, especially when during the Depression, my grandfather was very, very poor. And at one point, he even lost his farm. They went broke and had to sell their farm. And my grandmother worked in the as a cook in the mansion, the governor's mansion in Albany. She was a very good cook and she got a job as part of the service staff there. And my grandfather worked as a hired hand, a farm hand, on another person's farm. And eventually they saved enough money to buy another farm, which is where I used to go when I was a little boy, when we used to visit my grandparents. I often think about my grandfather. You know, he was somebody who just had a series of failures in life, you know, through no fault of his own, and he had a very difficult life. And my mother said that, she didn't have shoes in the summer. They just couldn't afford shoes, twice a year, basically. And so they would get a pair of shoes, and sometimes they were hand-me-downs from older brothers or sisters. And in the summer, people went barefoot, which is not such a hardship. But basically, my mother said that my grandfather would go into town to buy the groceries and things, my grandfather and my grandmother. And when they would come back, sometimes they would actually, like at special occasions, they'd bring an orange, right? And an orange was like a miracle. Yeah, can you imagine that? You know, now, you know, you go to the store and think, oranges, nah, you know, I'm not in the mood, you know. You know, we can get mangoes, papayas, we can get kiwi fruit, you know, it's the works, right? Back then, an orange was like an extraordinary thing. If you had an apple tree, you could raise apples, you know. But orange was like going to Hawaii, basically. You know, it was really extraordinary. So people had much less than they do now. In the United States, we tend to look at that as a tragic situation. When the Depression hit, there was a woman named Margaret Bourke White who went through the rural part of the United States and took photographs of all these people with their patched clothes and their very spare lives, you know. And the photographs were very popular because people would look at them and say, oh my gosh, you know, we've got to do something about this. This is terrible, you know, all these people living in poverty. You know, I myself think everybody should have a chance of getting education and medical care. And I do think people should be able to get, they shouldn't have to, wear hand-me-down shoes and things like that. But I do think, personally, that our way of life is not necessarily a good thing for us, you know. This life of superabundance. It creates, I think, a really careless mind. You know, people used to be careful of things, and also I think they used to respect them very highly. So, you know, a tool was hard to come by, and you took care of it. I know that my grandfather had a tool shed, and he had a tool which is called a scythe. He had a hand scythe and a big scythe. This was before lawnmowers, you know. And before, you had a lot of, you didn't have weed whackers. You actually had a hand tool, and you used to have to go, it's like a big, sharp, it's like a knife with a curved, very curved blade. And you swish it through the grass, and it cuts the grass, and you have to keep it very sharp, you know. And so that's how people used to cut. And I remember that he had a hand scythe that was like almost used up. He had sharpened the blade so often that a lot of it had been ground away. Imagine using a steel tool, using it up like that, you know. He was very careful, you know, in his workroom. Everything was, things like nuts and bolts, they didn't get thrown away. There were drawers for those, and spare items were kept around in case they might be handy, you know. I think this is really, creates a better mind, actually. We recite a sutra when we eat our meals that says, I will eat this food only for the purpose of keeping my body in good health, etc., etc. And that's a very nice sutra. But actually there's another meal sutra that some groups use, and one of the lines in it is, 1,000 labors have brought us this food. And that's really beautiful, right? Because, you know, we get the food and we don't think, you know, some guy in Mexico traveled 1,000 miles from his village in central Mexico, across the border, maybe illegally, with great difficulty, and his family are living down there, and he's living maybe the life of a migrant worker. And he's getting up at the crack of dawn to pick oranges, you know. And he must be very tired at night. And he picked this orange, you know. And we're eating it. But we're cut off from those kinds of connections, so it's just a product we buy. But I do think this mentality of 1,000 labors have brought, you know, trying to recall the effort that went into this, you know. I think maybe we're living in an interesting time because, within our own lifetime, we may, the age of the petroleum age may be coming to a close. And, things like weed whackers and even lawnmowers, you know, gas lawn. This all may be like, in 30 years, people may look back on that and think, what an amazing thing, you know. People used to use gas to mow their grass, you know. The other day, I have a gas lawnmower too, you know, and mine broke. And I have a hand mower also that I got at a used, at a garage sale. And I bought it in a moment of wanting to be virtuous, right? And so I took it out and I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to mow the lawn with this hand. And man, I thought, geez, am I out of shape, you know? I mean, those hand, you know, to do your lawn with a hand mower, oh my gosh, you know? That's work. I mean, really, you're not just pushing this machine, you know, it's doing... You have to cut the grass yourself. You know, you push that thing forward, and it's like, you know, you have to get up a head of steam, and you have to keep it up, and it's cutting the grass. And if you get too slow, it stops cutting the grass. So you really have to, you know, you really have to run fast. And I did the front yard, and I was just like, this is quick. I've got to fix my mower. You know, but. You know, I made a promise to myself, I am going to use this thing, you know. I'm not going to stick it back in the garage. But, you know, this world is coming, I think. And it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. You know, for years I've wanted to get rid of the grass in our yard because it's just totally wasteful, you know. And it would be great if people had to cut their grass with hand mowers, because they'd all get rid of the grass, you know. They'd plant some other kind of plant like ivy, and then they wouldn't have to put all these chemical fertilizers on their lawn. And if they did have grass, they would really have to love it, you know. Really. So I think there's something wrong with, I do think people should get, you know, the good part of what we've done is, you know, people shouldn't, like, my mother wanted to be a lawyer. So badly, she got out of high school, and my family, my mother's family, were like literally, you know, they were dirt poor, you know, and they owned their own farm, but they had very little cash, you know. And my grandfather had a truck, and when it would break down, he didn't take it into the, he'd try to fix it himself, you know. So, you know, my mother wanted so badly to go to the college, but at that time, most women didn't go to college. And even if women went to college, my mother was, you know, she just, you know, she was like, you know, out in the sticks. But she worked in a law office, and she loved the law. And I wish my mom had gotten a chance to be a lawyer, because... I think she'd have been a terribly good lawyer. I think she would have won every case, you know. My mother, because she had this passion, she loved the law, you know. She would have, you know, I don't know what she would have done. So that was kind of sad that my mother didn't get to be a lawyer. And I think we ought to try to make sure people have opportunities in life. But all the same, there's something about our way of life which is just insanely wasteful and careless. It's like a careless mind. And I'm no better than anybody else. But, you know, when we come to Sesshin, we have the chance to live in a deeper way, you know, where we really simplify our lives. And it's a little bit like in the old days, you know, where maybe people didn't get to choose simplicity. It was just something they had to live with. But we get to choose simplicity. And it's actually a very beautiful way to live, you know. You know, when we eat, there isn't like a menu, right? You don't say, well, here's the menu, what would you like, you know? And you say, oh, I like this, but could I get this on it, you know? Or, you know, it's just rice, you know. Ah, delicious. If you're hungry enough, rice is like heaven. And the vegetables, you know, and, you know, if you've been to Sesshin before, you pretty much know what you're going to get, you know. But I think it's always good because we're hungry and because we've been purifying our minds, we've been making them simple. And there's something, I think, really wrong with modern life. You know, it's not enough to have a house. It has to be, you know, I go for walks or jogs through Fanwood. In New Jersey, which is near where I live. And there are all these little houses that were built after World War II in what used to be the country. And they're small houses that were sort of like middle-class homes 60 years ago or 70 years ago. They're modest homes and they're perfectly good. But down the street, people are either remodeling or demolishing those homes. And what's taking their place is like these giant houses. It's just amazing. It's like the attack of the giant houses. You know? And there's something crazy about that, right? Really. I think that this simplicity of the life we have here is really good for our hearts and our minds. We're always looking, you know, it's not enough to have a nice house, it has to be a super duper house. And, you know, somebody on that street is going to be stuck with one, you know, at some point, somebody's kid is going to come home and go, how come we live in the little house, you know? And the parents are going to go, oh my God, we do. You know, we've got to remodel, you know, and they'll remodel, you know, or they'll go over and say, geez, you know, we thought we were happy, but we see we're not now, you know, we don't have a rec room, we've got to have a rec room, right, so then you add a rec room, and so on, and so on, and this is how it happens, but you know, a generation ago, people were so happy to be in those houses. Those people grew up probably in New York City in apartments. And they had little tiny apartments and they came out to New Jersey and thought, wow, this is the life, right? And they built a house and they thought, my God, our own house, you know? There's nobody living next door screaming through the walls, you know? And they probably thought they had, as we say, died and gone to heaven. But the next generation, or two generations later, they come in and say, this is not a house. You know? So this is like a process that we think, oh well, it's easy to see this. You know, it's easy to see these mansions, people call them, and have contempt for them. But we all have this spirit, you know, of not good enough. It's not good enough. And I'm not saying you shouldn't try to develop your talents and improve your circumstances. You know, if you live in a dump, you should try to get out of it. If you have a job you don't like, I'm not saying you should stick it out no matter what, because 100 years ago, somebody would have had to stick it out. That's not what I'm saying, but I think we do get we do have this like perpetual sense that you know, we're not, life it just isn't good enough. You know, we're falling behind, or we're not when you know everybody else is better off or living a better life, or the introduction says something kind of strange in this koan. Better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. Now that's a strange thing to say, see. Better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. Devadatta experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven while in uninterrupted hell. Now that's a very strange thing. You know, Devadatta was the Buddha's cousin. You know, the Buddha was a good guy, you know. And he was enlightened and deeply compassionate. And people who met him were just like moved to tears by his kindness. But he had a cousin named Ananda, who eventually became his attendant, and also eventually had Daikensho after many struggles. And is responsible, according to legend anyway, for the sutras, the Pali sutras. He had this incredible memory, and he helped to pass down the Buddha's teaching. But the Buddha had another cousin named Devadatta, who was like his evil cousin. You probably don't know this story. But Devadatta was really jealous of the Buddha. You know, he really wanted to be the Buddha himself, and he actually was started out as a follower of the Buddha, but he eventually wanted to like assassinate the Buddha. Really, it's really, you know. So if you think everything was just great back then, Devadatta was really tried to kill the Siddhartha Gautama. And so in Buddhism, Devadatta is thought to be like a really bad guy. You know? Yeah. So he's saying this really bad guy is in hell because he is such a bad guy. But you know what? Even in hell, you can ascend to a high level of enlightenment. And Udraka Ramaputra was a very holy and a deeply awakened person who was one of the teachers of the Buddha, and also known for his great compassion. And it said, he fell from heaven and wound up in the body of a flying wildcat, which would be like a monster or a demon. So this is about like somebody who is in hell going to the highest level, and somebody who's in who should be in heaven winding up in like a demon form. So it's basically called never good enough, right? Never good enough. As Dongshan and his spiritual uncle Mi were walking along, they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. Mi said, "Swift." Dongshan said, "How?" Mi said, "It's like a commoner being made a prime minister." Dongshan said, "Such a venerable old person still uses words like that?" And he said, "What would you say?" Dongshan said, "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty." Well, both of them are right. You know, both of them are right. Sesshin is this wonderful opportunity to experience life without judgment. Right? To experience life without judgment, without expectations or goals, gain and loss, right and wrong, right? And our whole culture, maybe all human culture, is about judgment. It's about getting ahead. It's about being successful. It's about being worthy, and so on and so on. Maybe this is inescapable. But it's all a fantasy. You know, someday, when we're running out of gas, somebody will, they'll run tours. You know, in 100 years, we'll all live in cities or on train lines. This might could be true, who knows. And they'll do tours of the New Jersey suburbs. And they'll get on, people will get in a bus and they'll go out and they'll say, look at these houses. Nobody lives there anymore. They're used to store hay. But and people will laugh and say, what is wrong with those houses? Were so big, you know, they'll have a good laugh. You know? What idiots built those giant houses? What were they thinking? You know, it's a dream. It's a dream. Now please live the dream. You know, please enjoy the dream. But when you come to Sesshin, you have this wonderful opportunity to experience the world as it is, as it really is. You know, and Zen practice is all about cultivating like kind of absolute simplicity. You know, and somebody came into the Dokusan room last night and said, "You know, I've been having some pain in my leg, but this evening I just realized it's just pain. It's just pain." And I could deal with it, you know. He said it really helped me to deal with it. I just realized, you know, it's just what it is. And I was thrilled, you know, that somebody said that, because that's a kind of mind that just says, okay, there it is, you know, that's what it is. This is, at this moment, there's pain. And that's the mind we're cultivating, and it's a very big mind. It connects us to everything around us in a way that the other mind, the judging mind, doesn't. And if you stay there long enough, you feel really good. Really, you have really sweet mind, sweet heart, happy, and deep sense of energy. And so this is a chance for us. You know, day two is like our chance to be simple. And we come to Sesshin with so much BS, you know. Yesterday, I love that that koan I read yesterday, where the guy comes into the teacher in Dokusan and he goes, oh man, you know, I don't know, I feel so unworthy, blah, blah, blah. Or he comes in and goes, what shall I do, north or south? Shall I go east or west? And he looks over and the teacher's like, oh, what was that? What would you say? The guy goes, what kind of a teacher are you, you bum? But it's like the guy says, please, you know, the BS is endless, right? You know, to put it bluntly, your BS is endless. My BS is endless, you know? So why go over it and over it and over it? You know, let's be simple. You know, before the Sesshin, plenty of BS, right? And, you know, am I good enough? Is it good enough? What's the future going to be? Why was the past the way it is? You know, and those, I don't mean to trivialize those things, right? There's all of that in the past, and then when you leave Sesshin, of course, there it is again. But for a little while, it's possible to live a bigger life. And it's just like, oh, ho-hum, you know. I didn't get a promotion, you know, ho-hum. You know, when my dad was dying, he was so bitter. My father got cancer. And my father's dream was that he was going to retire and live out on this farm. And he had bought this farm and he was going to live out there. And he had it all figured out. But then he got lung cancer, and he died within a couple of years. It was very protracted illness and so on. And he was so bitter. It was like, I'm only 69. I was supposed to be 85, right? And I've talked about this before, but I also had a chance once to meet a friend of Genki Roshi. I guess you could say that man was, how does it put it in the koan, a spiritual uncle. A better translation for this would be Dharma uncle. Dharma uncle me. So I trained with Genki Roshi, and I once sat with Edo Roshi. Edo would be my Dharma uncle. So this guy was also my Dharma uncle, and he was staying with Genki Roshi, and he was dying. And I've talked about this before. It was one of the things that made me think, God, there's something to this Zen, you know? Because this guy was so, I mean, he wasn't glad he was dying, you know? But he was dying. And he was so alive, and he was so in the moment. And there was real joy, even though he'd get very tired and have to lie down. You know, he didn't say, woe is me. You know, woe is me. And we all do it. I do it too. But he didn't do it. He didn't say, what a poor little boy am I. You know, life has dealt me such a bad hand. You know? He didn't want to spend, the last part of his life in the bullshit. You know, so he just stayed in the moment. He had a sweet mind and heart, because he didn't pick and choose. And that's how he went into the great transition. Yeah. So this is a chance to live that way today, even though everything we do before and after is all about gilding the lily. You know that expression? A lily is just as beautiful as it could be, but it's not good enough, right? We have to put gilt leaf on it. So I love that expression, gilding the lily. Means you take something that's already perfect and you try to improve it. But of course it doesn't get any better. Culture, civilization, it's all about gilding the lily. Right? But here it's possible to say, well, you know, let's just see things as they are. Let's just be really simple. And I think I think it's refreshing. It's so refreshing not to be unhappy all the time, isn't it? It's so refreshing not to be indecisive and pulled in different directions. It's so refreshing not to feel ashamed of yourself or unworthy. Or angry. As the koan says, favor and disgrace are disturbing. You know, isn't that actually favor and disgrace are disturbing? You know, we all know disgrace is disturbing, right? But favor is disturbing. You know? Favor is disturbing. You know, actually, winning is just as bad in a way as losing. Just as seductive, you know, because you get addicted to winning, right? I'll wrap it up, but I had a professor of mine who was a Marxist when I was in graduate school, and he wanted to convert me to Marxism. And that's what he was trying to do. And he was my best professor. He was fascinating. Basically, his lectures were like having somebody put an electric cord on your brain, right? He was so fascinating, you could hardly keep up with his ideas. And he was trying to seduce me, really, in my opinion. And he would give me these A's, and I knew these A's are like poison A's, you know? Because one day he was going to give me an A, and he wanted me to come in and go, "All right, comrade, I'm you." And by the way, I like equality, you know, I am like a socialist, but I'm not a Marxist, you know. So he didn't get to seduce me. And I knew those A's were like, I knew those A's, there was like a price tag attached to those A's. So a success is a very, it's just as seductive as failure. Favor and disgrace are disturbing. Both of them gilding the lily. Profoundly trust in yourself. See? Not your small self, in your true nature. Profoundly trust in your true nature. Before the sesshin and after, you can look north, east, south, and west in perpetual uncertainty. North, east, south, and west in perpetual discontent. North, east, south, and west in fear. And you could spin around and around. But here, it's trust in yourself. Be with your true nature. So refreshing. In the real state, one mixes tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. See, and today we're mixing our tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. Now they're just trying to survive, right? If you go to bed, if you make it to bed, 10:45 tonight, you lie down and think, I did it, right? That's heaven, right? I made it. A fisherman, in the old days, fishermen and woodcutters, these were like the humblest professions, right? So nobody said, oh, maybe if I'm lucky someday I'll become a woodcutter, right? This is like, Wei Neng, our great ancestor, was a woodcutter. That's like the humblest thing, right? So basically, at the end of a woodcutter's day, he says, well, I lived another day. I ate another day. How? I'm so grateful.